Okay, I am very happy to be back. I remember so well our meeting 3 years ago about this time, and it was also very spring-like. And so we were all in good moods after being picked up by God's spring. And what I want to speak about and why I'm here is an idea that has been playing with me for years, and it's something I just noticed that happens to me when I read the Confessions of St. Augustine. And I'll just give you a preview. It just seems God is more present when I read the Confessions of St. Augustine. I'll try to unpack that now these next couple of days. I would like to begin our conversation listening to how another person felt about the book we are going to consider, The Confessions of St. Augustine. It comes from the pen of the great St. Teresa of Avila. And she says, "At this time, they gave me the Confessions of St. Augustine. It seems the Lord ordained this because I had not tried to procure a copy, nor had I ever seen one. I am very fond of St. Augustine, because the convent where I stayed as a layperson belonged to his order, and also because he had been a sinner. For I found great consolation in sinners whom, after having been sinners, the Lord brought back to himself. It seemed to me I could find help in them, and that since the Lord had pardoned them, he could pardon me. But there was one thing that left me unconsolable, and that was that the Lord called them only once, and they did not turn back and fall again, whereas in my case I had turned back so often that I was worn out from it. But by considering the love he bore me, I regained my courage, for I had never lost confidence in his mercy. In myself I had lost it many times." That was the year 1565, some 1100 years or more after St. Augustine had written this most famous of his works, which can be found today on the prestigious lists of the Harvard Classics, the Penguin Classics, and the great books, as well in all the libraries of the world. And every year it is brought out in new translations or retranslations in even more languages. As mentioned, I remember in Rome hosting a Japanese Lutheran minister who was using our library because he was making a new translation of the Confessions into Japanese. And in fact, we said, "What is it about St. Augustine that appeals to the Japanese?" He said, "The interiority." Interesting. As in the time of St. Teresa, so today, 1600 years later, this 4th century African saint intimately engages his readers as he speaks of his conversion that culminated in a garden of Milan in the year 386. The Confessions of St. Augustine is unlike any book I know. Written 10 years after his conversion, it is the story of a saint, but it goes way beyond the power of saints' stories to inspire. It is an autobiography. Indeed, it may be the first autobiography ever. But it has a different effect on the reader than autobiographies by famous people, even those of holy people, like Teresa of Avila, Thomas Merton, and others. There is a power within. The pages of the Confessions have a way of containing God, so to speak, of bringing God to the surface and putting the reader in contact with God, something I have never found anyplace else. Maybe the word I'm looking for is proximity or nearness. God seems to be near when you are reading this book. Other books inform you, enlighten you, and inspire you. This book seems to bring God close to you during the time you have it in your hands. It could be because of the way Augustine speaks directly to God and not to you. The confessions are actually a long prayer directed to God. You keep finding the word you in it, but that you is God, not you. There are a few exceptions, but not many. One is when he asks his readers not to laugh at him as he spills out his youthful foolishness and hard-headed persistence. The same God who healed him of all that, he said, had most probably applied preventive medicine to you. That is, he kept you from being that way. And towards the end of the confessions, he asks all of us readers to pray for his deceased parents. However, these passages still pass through God before reaching us. What other book do you know that speaks so much to God other than the book of Psalms? After a time, you get used to God's being addressed, and he seems to belong right there in the book. Augustine even speaks to God with a kind of familiarity, using expressions such as you know, Lord, or, but why am I telling you this? Or it could be the way Augustine, when writing about Augustine, is not really writing about Augustine, but about God. It is not his own story that interests him, but God's mysterious ways. His story simply illustrates in the concrete how God works on all of us with effective mercy. For instance, there is the passage where he speaks of his mother, Monica's early urging to a decent and honorable sexual life. He said, "But these warnings seem to be mere woman's talk, which I would have blushed to heed. In truth, they came from you, but I failed to realize that, and assumed that you were silent, and she alone was talking." I like the passage where he talks about how a wise man once raised doubts in him about the value of astrology and horoscopes for telling him anything worthwhile about life. He says to God, "You gave this insight through that man." In any event, the book seems to vibrate with a life of its own. Something is going on in these pages when you open them up. You are brought back to the past 1600 years ago, but you are also brought to an exciting present while you have the book in your hands and are reading it. God approaches you from within, just like he approached Augustine. How this happens is what I want to talk about these days. To get an insight into this subtle presence of God amid the pages of the Confessions, I would like to draw your attention to three striking characteristics of the book that illustrate what I'm talking about. The first is the way in which Augustine presents God as actively intervening in his life in the most unexpected of ways and directing everything toward his good. God is behind the scenes of whatever is going on in the story, and you feel that this could be true also in your case. Listen to the way he speaks. That should be your next quote. "I dwelt upon these things, and you were near me. I sighed, and you heard me. I was wavering uncertainly, and you guided me. I was going the broad way of the world, and you did not forsake me." While reading the Confessions, we too could say, "I dwell on these things, and you are near me. I sigh, and you hear me. I waver uncertainly, and you guide me. I go along the broad way of the world, and you do not forsake me." The second characteristic that makes God seem so close by are the live conversations between Augustine and God that you often find. I like to call them spontaneous prayers. They crop up here and there in the confessions as he responds personally to what he is remembering of his past or hoping for in his future. As in this exclamation after his first inner discovery of a newly understood God. O eternal truth and true love and beloved eternity, you are my God. I sigh to you by day and by night. Finally, this subtle presence is found in the many expressions of his intense desire for God. The fire is transparent and has a way of revealing the object of his desire, namely the God Augustine is yearning for. We will take these all one at a time. The value of the book for us is different from that of other spiritual works, stories of saints or autobiographies by holy men and women. You don't read it simply to be informed about a great man and his times, to experience the spiritual insights of a mystic, or to learn about the teachings of a church father. I would dare to say that its greatest use to us lies in the way it brings us in contact with the living God and lets us touch his traces and feel his nearness. A first reading of the Confessions would serve generally to gather information. Information about the man Augustine, names, places, important moments in his story, his writing style, etc. A second reading would be to return to those passages of the book that made an impression on me the first time, and I want to deepen it. A third, I'm trying to get you all ready to read the Confessions three times. A third and subsequent reading would be in order to enter into contact with the God who seems to hover amid the pages. This probably already begins during the second reading. So, the first way that I say Augustine, God seems to be present in the Confessions. That's what we'll do for the rest of this encounter. God's way of entering into Augustine's life. When he was just 20 years old, Augustine suffered a great loss that was to throw him off kilter for the first time in his rather protected life. His closest friend died after a short illness. The young Augustine fell into a deep depression and lost all his bearings as a result. He said this about himself at the time, "I became a great enigma to myself, a magna questio, and I was forever asking my soul why it was sad and why it disquieted me so sorely, and my soul knew not what to answer me." His friend's death had challenged his unreflected way of living and set him questioning his very existence as never before, a questioning that was to go on for a very long time and would eventually lead to his conversion. Augustine uses a choice phrase to describe what God was doing in him at that time. He says, "You turn us to yourself by ways most wonderful." In Latin, mirus modis. Mirus modis in Latin is the Latin he chose for ways most wonderful. Wonderful in the sense of causing wonder. Ways that are marvelous when they are finally understood. I could use the word awesome, but unfortunately that word has lost its force today. God was wonderfully drawing good out of that tragic situation, simply by turning Augustine into an enigma to himself, a question, magna questio, as he himself described it, and set him questioning. He uses the expression mirus modus again when describing another crucial moment in his life. It was the time he was let down by a man who was supposed to answer all his doubts regarding the Manichaean sect he belonged to and was becoming uncomfortable with. As it turned out, Faustus, the promised guru, wasn't up to the task and left Augustine totally disillusioned and later disinterested. And I quote, Augustine said, "Thus it came about that this Faustus, who was a death trap for many, unwittingly and without intending it, began to spring the trap in which I was caught, for thanks to your hidden providence, O my God, your hands did not let go of my soul. You dealt with me in wondrous ways." Again, meatus modus. Here are two moments in which Augustine tells us that he was forced to question many of his assumptions and carry on a whole new search. Both were brought about through what Augustine calls God's wondrous ways. These and several other wondrous ways that turned him back to God constitute a core motif of the Book of the Confessions. As they are narrated in the concrete, we could sense God hovering around Augustine's life with a merciful hand. These were life situations that forced him to question. There were also life situations that forced him to act. In Book 5, Augustine speaks with conviction of the unruly students he had to put up with in Carthage as a teacher, and his ambition to leave Africa to go to Rome and advance his career. He says they were all part of a divine plan. Like a playwright, God got him to go across the sea and over into Italy, where certain personalities, particularly St. Ambrose of Milan, would be influential on him for his conversion. He says about this leaving Africa and sailing for Rome, "It was by your action upon me that I was moved to go to Rome and teach there what I had taught in Carthage. Why I left the one country and went to the other, you knew, O God, but you didn't tell either me or my mother. But you, O my hope, you forced me to change countries for my soul's salvation. You pricked me with such goads at Carthage as drove me out of it, and you set before me certain attractions by which I might be drawn to Rome." Later, he went to Milan to take up the chair of rhetoric in the emperor's court and to be providentially near St. Ambrose, the bishop of Milan. And he said of him, "All unknowingly, I was brought by you to him, so that knowingly I may be brought by him to you." This was true also with books he read. We can see God intervening through them. For instance, those he was assigned in class. Upon completing Cicero's Hortensius with its defense of philosophy, or better, the love of wisdom, he dropped all pretense of acquiring merely an eloquent speaking style and earnestly took up a search for truth. This was the beginning of his conversion. He said, "I had begun to rise up again and return to you," paraphrasing the words of the prodigal son. The same can be said for the works he read of the Neoplatonist philosophers not long before his conversion. It is interesting how Augustine saw God to be so near in these reflective moments. He says, "I had become more wretched and you more close to me. Your right hand was ready to pluck me from the mire and wash me clean, though I knew it not." There's another way that Augustine saw God intervening. It happened at birth when God placed in him his best personal qualities. At the end of book one, the one in which he talks of his childhood, he utters this prayer of thanks. He says, "Yet, Lord, I should have owed thanks to you, my God and the most excellent creator and ruler of the universe, even if it had been your will that I should not live beyond boyhood. For even then, I felt, even so early, I had an instinct for the care of my own being. In my interior sense, I kept guard over the integrity of my outward sense perception. And in my small thoughts, upon small matters, I had come to delight in the truth. I hated to be wrong, had a vigorous memory, was well trained in speech, delighted in friendship, shunned pain, meanness, and ignorance. In so small a creature, was not all this admirable and reason for praise? Yet all these things were the gifts of my God, for I did not give them to myself. All these were good, and all these were I." Finally, God seems to have intervened in Augustine's life from within in a kind of a negative way, taking the fun out of all his illicit pleasures, so that he would look further for the happiness he sought. He says, "You were always by me, mercifully hard upon me, and besprinkling all my illicit pleasures with certain elements of bitterness, to draw me to seek for pleasures in which no bitterness should be. And where was I to find such pleasures, save in you, O Lord, who use sorrow to teach, and wound us to heal, and kill us lest we die to you?" All this gives the impression to the reader of God's being present to Augustine all during his life. You can never think of Augustine without thinking of God right beside him. And so you can never think of yourself without thinking of God right beside you. As you read the Confessions, you feel God so close to Augustine's life story, aware or unaware as he might have been of it, that God must be close to your own story. If Augustine, then why not me? And so the Confessions become a bridge between what Augustine is saying about God in his life and the God you are experiencing in yours. What's going on in those pages is going on in you now. So that's the first way I feel like God seems close. You might remember 3 years ago some of the things I talked. I used those expressions: outer providence, inner providence, and negative providence. They're contained here. I didn't use the expressions, but when I talked about outer providence, when I talked here about the circumstances, the death of his friend, or the disappointment, and also the pain that sin brings, that would be the negative providence I talked about before. When I talked about his having unruly students in Carthage and wanting to get out of there and go to Italy, that would be something like the outer providence I talked, or reading the book of Cicero, or his mother and her wise advice, or the man who disillusioned him with astrology. That would be what I call outer providence. And then the inner providence, when I used an example here of his discovering his gifts, those gifts that were uniquely his, or the unique combination, and of course inviting us to discover ours. So anyway, that's the first set of points I wanted to make about how God seems so close in the Confessions. As he's writing the book, he's discovering that God was always there in this moment, in that moment, the other moment. It was actually probably very therapeutic for Augustine to write the book, because he went back and looked at it all, and he discovered you were always there. You were always by me. And then he gets very concrete, giving examples. how God was always right there. But when you read that, you start thinking about your own life. It could really be those wondrous ways, miris modis. You know, maybe that's happened to me too. And it seems like it's active there. Why not in me? Or the negative providence I talked about, the hard things that we've had to have in life, the disappointments, the pain, the suffering. Augustine says, you were always there. And I said to myself, yeah, maybe he's always there too in my life. And maybe he's there now, you know, doing this. And then the gifts. Augustine spells out his gifts with utter humility. Can we spell out our gifts with utter humility, saying all these are gifts of God and all these are I? So tomorrow we're going to talk about the spontaneous prayers. But these are just my I hope it's not idiosyncratic, but my instincts feels about the how God seems so close in the pages of the confession. And I challenge you to try it out. And the quotes, were all the quotes there, the ones I gave? Good. And we'll have more quotes tomorrow with more photocopy pages. Any questions? Any observations? I'm happy to answer questions, but maybe it's something you'd more like to talk about to each other.
I remember when I was a student in Dublin, I was thinking it was time to give it all up. And I was talking to one of the priests in the community, and he says, look at the community now, look at the people around you. They went through the same thing, or they've gone through the same thing. Just keep going. And then Augustine, when he was looking at the example of the people who've given up everything and gone out in the desert, and you know, why can't I, he says. So the parallels are always there. And so what I'm sure that what you're saying is perfectly true, that we are expected, I don't know whether he thought of it at the time, but I think we are expected to reflect upon it as affecting our lives too. Mm-hmm.
It's recognizing in the here and now, whatever the day brings, that God is there.
Mm.
Father David, some stuff that he said, that sometimes when you're going through the really difficult bits, those are special moments of grace, but you don't recognize it. Mm. And it's being able to sort of stop and say, my head, where are you now?
Mm.
It's that. Because he's here. You don't recognize it.
Bow on. And sometimes feel alone.
Yes. I'm going to say very similarly, the text here, the quotation, I have become more wretched and you more closer to me.
In a very bad moment, I came across, I became more wretched, and you more close to me. And you think in those wretched moments that God is a long way off, and you know that he isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's so enlightening.
I think it's
so precious.
Yes, you think he turns back on you in those moments, no, wouldn't
that's
it?
That's right.
Yes.
Can I just ask you about his closest friend's death? Why exactly then was he so sad?
Well, he explains it. It's in book four. He explains it that he was, you know, this was a deep, wonderful friendship. He's only 20 years old.
Yeah.
His father had just died not long before that, but he doesn't say much about it. I always look at it as saying that, and he says later, he says, I remember exactly, I could find the quote. In fact, I thought I brought my book down, but I didn't. But, oh, how foolish I was not to love a man as a man. Meaning, thinking that the person could go on living forever. Not loving anyone, anybody, or anything, to realize that it's limited.
So he didn't love enough? He felt that he didn't love enough? Or he thought he loved
Well, he didn't love in the right way.
Ah.
In other words, he loved his deepest friend without ever thinking that his deepest friend could disappear.
Well, that it was a gift from God, the friendship.
Yes, but I think that he spells out how he learned how to love later, realizing that you can lose that person by death. Sometimes, unfortunately, by breakup of a friendship, too, which is very painful. And that's what he says, I put my everything into a human being who was not necessarily going to live forever, and didn't.
Yeah.
And that's where I think he even said he fled his hometown and went to Carthage because he just couldn't manage. He was seeing all these familiar places where they would be with each other, and he didn't want to see them anymore. He went to Carthage, he says, and I started making the same mistake again. I started making more friendship and putting everything I had into them and setting myself up for another one. Another disappointment, another pain.
It's the ultimate nature of human loss, really.
Oh, it is. That's right. But at 20 years old, you're not that aware of it. Yeah.
But it happens at much younger age than that.
Oh, sure. Sure.
I think there was a minute when he saw the wisdom of what his mother was saying about his sexual relationships.
Certainly by the time he's writing the book. But not 10 years later, or actually more than 10 years after his conversion. So even more, about maybe 15 or so.
But he was a man of his time, wasn't he? He wasn't being a wicked person, it was the normal
That's right.
way of life, wasn't it?
That's right. But I think he would be saying in his confessions that was the normal way of life, but maybe it still was violent to the best of the human nature.
Mm-hmm.
And it would happen in any century.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened in the 4th century, it could happen in the 21st century, it happened in the 15th century, that it might be what everybody's doing, but at the same time it's going against the best of you.
This might not make sense, but do you feel at some point his academia stood in the way of his faith?
Mm. Probably the deep studies he did, no, because when he was reading the book of Cicero and discovered Cicero promoting the study of philosophy, namely the love of wisdom, that made it was a great liberating effect to him. He stopped thinking just about speaking style and started looking for content. And then further asking more and more questions, he found himself led to reading the Neoplatonists, who gave him new mental categories in which he could think more spiritually. On the other hand, a lot of his studies were done on how to speak well, how to win friends and influence people. And he said that would have gotten in the way, becoming a great orator just for the sake of being a great orator, using words well, but not... And he certainly learned to use words well, and he eventually used that quality for wonderful things as a bishop, as a preacher, and all that. So I think the things he was studying was if it led him just to be concentrating on impressing people and teaching people how to impress people, and all that, yes, that would have gotten in the way. And it took him a long time to get out of that, because he was still convinced, even though he was looking for truth, and there's kind of a fight going on inside himself, even in an intellectual way, because there's one wonderful passage in book 7 where he really is convinced that he wants to give himself over to Christ, and he said, why not now, why not to just, he said, but on the other hand, I have to prepare classes for my students, and I make money from them, and if I keep in here, I could be given the governorship someday, but I really want to follow, but then on the other hand, it's wonderful, entertaining reading right there. And so he just couldn't let go of that until later. And then when he had his conversion, the first thing he did was give up his job. He had a very important position, in the court of the emperor. And that was the first, and I always call that was the proof of the pudding, that he was converted when he quit his job.
And
he gave up all possible.
Norman Vincent Peale.
Yes, right.
Could you suggest a reasonably accessible publication that would people who have never come across this guy before start to read about it? I mean, obviously read the book itself, but
right. Yeah, and it's probably better to start with something other than yeah. I would ask Father Ben about it, because I'm not, you know, I'm living in Italy and all, and I'm not as much in, but there's some very good introductions to it. Or what some of the things he's written, yes.
You wrote
for the
CTX,
didn't
you?
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the text itself.
Yes, there's a very good book that I think it might be back in print, Guardini's, the Conversion of Augustine, Romano Guardini, he really goes into the. It might be difficult reading. I've used it a lot. I like it a lot, but I don't know if it's a good introduction. But there, I think Father Ben could give you good advice on a book to read before you read the Confessions, or maybe as you read the Confessions. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Are there different images of St. Augustine, Father Brian, or is this an accurate portrayal of the picture in the alcove there, or are there different images?
Oh, that's the one that was just discovered, right? The
Caravaggio.
I don't think we have any idea what he looked like. Although I think we can get some idea of some of the racial characteristics, knowing the Berber people who live in North Africa. I tried to find out, who did I ask the other day, somebody who really knows, was his father African or not? His mother definitely so. The name Monica is a thoroughly African name. And it contains the name of an African god, but I don't remember exactly how that, thoroughly African. But his father had a Roman name, and some people say they don't think he was had African roots, but he was in the Roman bureaucracy and things. So he didn't get his... hoping that they would say, yes, he was more African. So I guess there's probably a mixture there. But what he really looked like, I don't think anybody has an idea. They didn't paint saints' portraits in those days.
The oldest one is 3rd century, isn't it?
Right. And they do have him kind of balding. And there's a... Down in Annaba, where he was bishop, they sell a holy card. Where they have him a bald... thin and bald, but who knows? That's a nice one. I'm glad you were able to get a nice copy of that.
The saints always look Italian.
They always make them look Italian. And when I show the frescoes at San Gimignano, one of the first things I always say is, Augustine was not European. And they, what? You know, what do you mean? He's
and, big shock.
Just like, you know, Mary and Jesus did not look European at all, but they do in the art.
I recall looking at, I think it must have been about 20 various portraits of Augustine in the pre-monasterian monastery in Prague.
Mm-hmm.
Along one passage, there were about 20 or more of them. They're all different.
Yeah.
Not one. One might say that
they're
more European than
that. Oh, that's right. But even St. Peter, they all seem to tend to paint St. Peter similar. A lot of white beard, right? And a lot of hair. And St. Paul's always bald with a sharp, dark beard. Who knows what he looked like?
The horrible truth was probably a picture of the artist himself, you know?
Yeah.
Posing his own pictures onto the paint.
Yeah. But the one thing we know, that Augustine spoke Latin with a definite African accent, and he was teased about it when he was in Italy, and he says that, not in the Confessions, but he says it in one of his it was just like someone who comes from I don't know. Well, we had different. I have an American accent, an Australian accent. We recognize immediately, and he had a very definite African accent. And the highbrows in Milan made fun of him, like who's this country bumpkin coming up?
Especially as he was made the orator.
Yeah, yeah.
Strange that.
Well, but you know, a good orator, if he has an identifiable accent but speaks well, mm-hmm. His personality is even more there. Mm-hmm. As long as he's not driving you crazy with the way he speaks, but you can say, well, I know he's Southern American, you know, the Southern draw. There's some of our best speakers have this Southern draw, and they but they're marvelous speakers. And, I think President Obama is a wonderful speaker.
Yes.
And he's got an accent. I mean, you know who's speaking there. So I guess the custom, and probably in Milan. Milan was made the capital of the Roman Empire because the Romans had moved up into here, into Britain, into Hungary. They had gone that far up into Europe, and Rome was too far, so they moved their court up to Milan. Well, that must have been a pretty international place, and they must have had people from all their lands there, and they must have heard a lot of accents. Although, by then, I would think the Latin language had been quite imposed, just like the Greek language had been imposed on the world before them. It's interesting. But he said, I guess, who was I talking to? Somebody who really knows it, I forget. But he said that he never lost that. I thought maybe he would have gotten pompous in it, but no, he's never lost the African accent. I like to think of him having something that way. It's,
You talked about now and then. What attracts a friar today then to Augustine as opposed to St. Francis or Dominic or Benedict?
I wish you could have been with it. I haven't read it yet. Last week we had Father Johnny and Father Carlos Alonso, who in the community down in London, brought 10 young people with us, with them, to get some Augustine information from us in San Gimignano. And I gave talks first day, second day was Father Ian, and the third day was our Peruvian, Delfio Lopez, who was just ordained a priest in November. And I said, Delphia, why don't you give them a talk too? And Carlos can translate it into English. His English isn't perfect, but still, it'd be a nice encounter. I said, tell us what a young man your age, he's 35, but he's been in the order for a while, but he waited a while to be ordained. Tell us why do you like Augustine? What attracts you about Augustine? And what do you think would attract young people today, wherever, let's say in Peru or anywhere, to him? And I said, could you let me see what you wrote? Well, he didn't print it. He read it from his computer, and he still has to send it to me on the email. But I'd love to hear what he had said, because they liked it. Apparently, the people that had come to San Gimignano. I thought he didn't have to prepare a heady talk or anything. Just what do you like about Augustine as compared with Saint Francis or Saint Dominic or John Bosco, and what do you think young people would like about him today? But I don't have it. If I get it, I send it to, what's it be in Spanish? I don't know. What do you think young people would... We're all trying to figure out how to draw people to Augustine in a religious life setting, not just to read Augustine and to like Augustine, but to maybe follow Augustine, and how to do it, right? David would probably have it on his mind more than any of us, how to do it.
I think young people would have lots of friends.
Yes, I've
said they like to live. They don't. They live in lots of places separately. They like to come together.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that community thing. Both our girls have friends from when they were at school, when they were in their 30s. And these friends still like to come together.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do it very often because they've all got families or children, but they come together in the summer. A whole lot, husbands, children, and they love this come together. And I think that's very appealing.
Yeah, you know, I was down in Rome for 2 different weeks. We had an international renewal course in Rome in English, and they came from 14, 15 countries, Augustine men and women. Anyway, they were very impressed by something that we, there's a man in my province, Gary McCluskey, who has been teaching in university level for a long time, and he was talking about Augustinian education. And he said something, he said, people frequently ask us, we have a big university in the United States, Villanova University, and sometimes going around promoting, you get students there, they say, well, what's the difference between a Jesuit university and an Augustinian university? And he came up with this formula. I don't know, I'd like to hear what David and Bernard had to say about it. He says, the Jesuits say they prepare men and women to be men and women for others. The Augustinians prepare men and women to be men and women with others. Yeah. I don't know if that... That's interesting. Very simple formula there, but I don't know what if that makes an...
It's a community, but not a closed. It's an all-embracing community.
Mm-hmm. Peter, excuse me for a little while.
Sure.
I was never conscious of that as the stated purpose.
No, I don't think I've ever seen it stated.
But from a very closed existence in the novitiate, and a more or less closed existence as a student in Ireland, the horizons then began to open up. Rome, school, parents, associations, and then, there's been a gradual opening up, and I can see it would be true today, I think, preparing somebody to live with others.
Mm.
Because, by and large, I think the community ideal has become more central to us. It might always have been there,
mm-hmm.
but it's become more central and more sought after now. And that's why this youth, a young community in London is kind of sparking interest here and there, because it may answer questions, and everybody has questions, quite not quite as intense as Augustine's questions, but they all need some line of direction and a line of search.
Yeah.
And how Augustinians changed over the centuries. The rule is supposed to be, isn't it, based on, or is Augustine's, it was found again in the 10th century or whatever it was. But how is it that interiority didn't seem to figure very much?
In the rule.
Mm.
It's because he wrote the rule for the community he was living in Hippo as a priest and with laymen. And then when he was made a bishop, and it was impossible for him to keep in that community because bishop had received people coming left and right and all that. So he left the rule for them of how to order themselves. And his main thrust to them as living community, because he was thinking of this community of men. He wasn't writing a treatise on spirituality. He certainly spoke about interiority in his homilies and in his other writings. But he was leaving them kind of a message, for more than a message, what he calls a precepts of how to live together. And he put great emphasis on unity of heart and mind, putting the common good before the one's own good. But he wasn't telling them how to... There's a very short section on prayer, and he only just says, make sure your mind concentrates on what your lips are saying. But he doesn't say any more. It's a very short rule anyway. But he's not writing a spiritual treatise. That's a very important thing to point out. Now, St. Benedict wrote about 150 years later, whatever it was, and he wrote a very, very long thing, and he also prescribed everything you're supposed to do every day. But Augustine wasn't doing that. But when you draw out of what Augustine wrote, you find this wonderful emphasis on love above all, that is really bringing the presence of God among them. If you would say, Augustine, why don't you say something about interiority? He says, I do, but that I'm not going to do that in this rule that I'm leaving for the community after I go. But we as Augustinians have decided not to just stay with the rule. That's why we go back to Augustine and read his other works and how can he inspire us, and we do discover the interiority of Augustine and find it very nourishing.
I think for a contemporary woman as well, Augustine really appeals, in the sense that it's active and contemplative, and that rather appeals to women of a certain age, shall we say, were brought up in the 70s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got a dynamic that is liberating and freeing. And you can hear St. Augustine not speaking to men, but also speaking to a contemporary woman. And mm-hmm. that possibly appeals to younger women as well,
uh-huh.
as a role model.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we have a number of women, the ones who worked so hard on the AYE 2 years ago, and find Augustine tremendously attractive.
Mm.
And yet he doesn't give a lot of power to women in his own life, does he?
No, I would say he was a typical man of the 4th century.
You need to get over that, to ignore that angle.
And also, we do tend to ignore, and I'm quite happy to do it, all the things that put other people off. Like some of the things he said about that got into the church. And we ignore that, don't we?
Mm.
Perhaps this as well.
Well, because he said so much.
Yes.
But I guess his attitude towards women, I wouldn't say, his mother, of course, at the end,
yes.
not at the beginning, but the end, and he did say he loved his concubine deeply.
Yes.
But you're right, when he gets into preaching all that, Eve doesn't come off too well. He really has, and women in general, it's, but again, it was his time.
And was original sin before him, or is he the one who voiced that?
That it seems that they're saying that he was really the first to really take that concept and develop it from Paul, but that it even says more than Paul,
right.
Much more than Paul.
But it's like all these things that you're drawn to somebody for their positive attitude, or the positive. And you can actually forget the rest,
yeah.
because it's the positive you're looking for.
Yes.
It's that the bits that help me, there are bits of other saints that help me, but the Augustine for me is the person that I find helps me in my walk. You just identify with him. There are bits that I find really uncomfortable about Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
There are bits that I've read and come across and sort of going, oh, I'm not sure about that.
I like that.
And yes, to some extent, yeah, I do sweep them under the carpet
mm-hmm.
because for me at that point it's not helpful. And I, at some stage I may have to come headlong against it, but I think God will show me when that time is right for me. But when I try to do it, all sorts of unpalatable bits I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I have to focus on the bits for me that are really positive, that help me from day to day.
But it's the bits, it's what other people do with it that affects everybody else's attitudes. Like to what happens to babies.
Yeah.
And all that kind of thing. And that's not Augustine's fault, perhaps. But it's what we've done with it.
Well, it seemed like he loved to fight, and the older he got, the more he loved it, and he found fights, and towards the end of his life, he was fighting very much with the the name's sort of slipping by me, the No, the ones about saying we're self-sufficient and
Pelagians,
that's the word. And he really got, and a lot of people said he got carried away in this, but especially when condemning unbaptized babies to damnation, it's like, what's going on? He was trying so hard to save, to defend the concept that our salvation comes from God and not from us. And in the heat of polemic, it seems to have brought us to some uncomfortable affirmations of what God was like. So we've had some Augustinians in the past in Rome who defend him in absolutely everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he said no wrong, and it, and he also said he thought of this first and he saw that first. Our new cardinal, you heard we have a new cardinal of Prosper Greek, one time he said to Father Trappe, and yes, and Augustine invented the telephone.
Where he had written, I had become more wretched, knew more close to me. Was he aware of what was, that it was God that is helping him from the mire, pulling him out?
Not at the moment. Later.
Now, isn't this a natural phenomenon that happened to each and every human being, that when we get to the lowest point of despair, we feel so wretched, so we really don't know what, where to turn or what to do, and then suddenly something dawned upon us, and then we realize that there's something greater than what is around us. Is
yes. Well, maybe we've all had experience like that. I think one of the fruits of reading the Confessions could be, one of the many fruits of reading the Confessions, when I find myself in great pain or sorrow or disappointment, having read this and thought about it, am I able to say, what's the good present there? I mean, maybe that's a lesson we get out of reading Augustine, to stop and not give up, not just feel sorry for ourselves, not say, woe is me, and world no damn good, you know. I remember Augustine talking about how he learned from this situation. What can I learn? Is there something, is God present here? If he is, how? Even though my situation is just awful, and I don't know what way to take, but I remember Augustine saying that he had it many times in his life, and you were always there. Can I stop? Can I step back? Can I enter into prayer and say, okay, I believe that you're here, but I'm not sure how, and pray about that. I think that would be a great, wonderful thing if we could do that, because, you know, I think we've all had them, those experiences, and I think we're all going to have some more. Can we, in the next one, say, how is God's presence here right now? Or can I just at least believe it and hang in there, knowing? Because when everything's going well and I'm reading Confessions, say, oh, look, isn't that wonderful how God was so close to Augustine at that moment. Now, how about me? If I'm feeling great now, there's no need for it. How about I'm not feeling great? How about things are falling apart? Can I remember that and say, Lord, I believe you're here. I believe that you're going to bring something better. It's a wonderful experience, I think, when, for recording about St. Monica. Monica was praying for 14 years, for a long time, for his conversion. When he was in Africa and he was thinking of going to Rome, she was against it. She was a real Mediterranean mother. You know, how's he going to be converted far from me? And she opposed it. And her prayer changed. The prayer from saying, but Lord, bring my son to conversion, began to say, Lord, don't let him sail. And Augustine says, after he sails off, he says, Lord, you did not listen to her recent prayer so you could answer her prayer of always. But she didn't know that. Because by his going to Italy, he's going to meet Ambrose, he's going to meet Simplicianus, he's going to run into certain books, he had some close African friends that were going to also be a help. But he didn't know that, Monica didn't know that, only God knew that. And poor Monica was so perplexed when he left. And she said she was angry with God, because you seem to treat her prayer so lightly. But he said, what prayer? The prayer that he not sail, or the prayer that he be converted? And you did not listen to the prayer, her recent prayer, so you could answer her prayer always. Well, we could say the same thing. What's my deepest desire? What are less deep desires? What do I pray for? Sometimes I pray for the same thing constantly. I'm not praying for the conversion of a son or anything, but But I am praying for lesser things too. And when I don't get the lesser thing, does God still have something in mind? Something better, something bigger. Again, Augustine's story is so concrete, so real, so believable, that we can really learn things about our own lives. So when it seems like God has not answered my prayer, it may be he just said no. He's allowed to say no too, you know. Maybe he's got something better in mind, and we don't know what that is, but can we trust? And that's what the case was with his mother. God said no to the prayer that he not sail, and said yes to the prayer for his conversion in God's way.
If we're expecting God to say yes to all our prayers, we're in effect trying to control him, aren't we?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Let's have got off the hook a bit, though, doesn't it? Because if we say that God is working through us and saying yes, then what about when man or woman does things that are not so great, and we say, oh, God, it's God working through him saying no? I mean, you can't really have it. How can you have that both ways if God is good? Someone does an evil thing. Oh, that's God working through doing an evil thing to trip you up so that you think about what you're doing to do a good thing. It just doesn't make sense if God is a loving God.
Augustine would have more said God would allow the person. No, Augustine would say God is able, because we're free. God will never take our freedom away from us, because that's not the way God works. But is able to draw good out of
the
bad things we do. You're mentioning.
Well, the bad things other people do to
or
us.
Or other people, things people do to us, yes.
Mm-hmm. Because that's the nub, isn't it, really? Free will.
Mm-hmm.
When we're actually the victim of free will.
Yeah, we're the victim, but it's our greatest glory to be free, even though we may not use it right.
Mm-hmm.
But the worst thing God could do to us would be take away our free will. Then we wouldn't be really a human being. It seems God has limited himself right from the very beginning by creating, allowing us to become free. All of a sudden, he cannot make us do what we need to do. He won't. He's going to respect that freedom all along. Augustine has some wonderful ways of talking about grace. He says God seduces us into doing good. He doesn't make us do good, but his grace seduces us in the sense of giving a delight to what is best. And delight is the right word. It's very close to delectatio in Latin. In other words, God makes the good and the best attractive to us, but doesn't take away our freedom. We can also still choose ourselves or choose violence or whatever. It's always playing with the idea of freedom. How does God bring about with grace, growth, human growth, and all, but leaving us free? And I think they'll talk about till the cows come home. And we could talk about that more too, because that's a tricky thing.
Mm-hmm.
Time for a break. Time for a rest.
Thank you.
Enjoy the sun.